Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall on this rainy Friday. Thanks so much for hanging with us. Today, it's another installment in our series of Conversations with the Candidates. My guest is John King. He's an educator who served as the Secretary of Education from 2015 to 2017 during the last couple of years of the Obama administration. Following that, he was appointed President and CEO of the Education Trust, a nonprofit that advocates on behalf of students of color and students from low-income families. From 2011 to 2015, Dr. King was the Commissioner of Education of the State of New York. Dr. King holds an undergraduate degree from Harvard, a master's degree and doctorate in education from Columbia, and a law degree from the Yale Law School. He is 47 years old. He is married to a fellow educator, Melissa Steele King. They have two school-aged children, and they live in Silver Spring. This is John King's first campaign for public office. He is one of 10 contenders in the gubernatorial primary. Dr. King has chosen Michelle Seary, the executive director of the Women's Law Center of Maryland, as his running mate for lieutenant governor. John King joins us on Zoom. You are welcome to join us as well. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org, and you can tweet us at @midday_WIPR. Dr. King, welcome.
Thanks so much. Excited to join you.
So this is your first stab at elective office. Why is elective office attractive to you, and why this particular office, governor?
Sure. Well, I have a very deep belief in the role that public institutions can play in people's lives, grounded in my own experience as a kid. Both my parents were educators, but they both passed away when I was little. My mom when I was 8 and my dad when I was 12. And in the period when it was just my dad and me, my dad was struggling with Alzheimer's. So home was incredibly difficult. And the thing that saved me was school. It was the one place in my life that was safe and supportive. And that's really what's driven my whole career, led me to become a teacher and principal and Secretary of Education for President Obama. And so I've always, as an educator, been very conscious of how the other systems in kids' lives affect them, housing, healthcare, criminal justice system, and always had the belief that public institutions can help make people's lives better. And governors are uniquely positioned, I believe, to work across the different policy silos to make sure that government is helping make people's everyday lives better.
So your life story, which really is both very troubled and sad and inspirational, given how you overcame, you know, a number of really, really tough challenges as a little kid, it is central to your campaign. It's interesting that, you know, you're quick to bring up the sort of the big points of it. Your mom passing away when you were 8 years old, your dad when you were 12. I wonder if there's anything in particular about that trauma and the incredible difficulty that any child would go through living through that those two, you know, almost back-to-back challenges. Anything about the trauma that prepares you to be in politics and to be a political leader and to, in particular, to run a state government? Is there a lineage?
Yeah, look, I very much empathize with folks' day-to-day struggles because of the ways in which I struggled. You know, when my mom passed, I just felt incredibly lost. I mean, there's no words to describe how heartbroken I was. And then with my dad struggling with Alzheimer's, home was just incredibly unstable and scary. I didn't know what it'd be like from one night to the next. Some nights he'd talk to me. Some nights he wouldn't say a word. Some nights he'd be sad, angry, and I didn't know why. And so I'm just deeply conscious of how hard those kind of day-to-day struggles can be for kids and families. And I was very lucky. My life story is really about the right institutions intervening in the right moment. I was very lucky to have phenomenal public school teachers who made school this place where I could be a kid when I wasn't able to at home. And so when I think about the challenge of the single mom who is struggling to make ends meet, when I think about the person who's struggling to get to work, taking more than 2 hours because the bus service is unreliable in Baltimore, when I think about the person who's worried about losing their family farm on the Eastern Shore, I can relate to both the pain and also the sense that if only government could do more to be helpful. And that's really what drives me as a public servant.
John King is my guest. He is one of 10 folks running for governor in the Democratic primary. Primary is in July. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you have a question or a comment for Dr. King, 410-662-8780. Our email's midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. And Dr. King, another candidate in this race, Wes Moore, came to great attention around the country because of a memoir he wrote about his life story, which also had more than a few bumps in it. And he compared in this memoir his fate to the fate of another guy who happened to be also named Wes Moore. But the Moore campaign has filed a complaint with the Maryland Board of Elections, accusing your campaign of circulating information that calls Mr. Moore's credibility into question. Did your campaign circulate information about Wes Moore? And do you think Mr. Moore's credibility should be called into question?
Well, let me be very clear. The allegations in the complaint are false. Our campaign was not involved in what's alleged in the complaint. And, I think, sadly, it was an effort by candidate Moore to distract from, what the press has been reporting now for several weeks. Many, many questions about his background, his claims about his experiences and he has to answer those questions. Ultimately, I think it's important for candidates to be vetted. I went through Senate confirmation, have been vetted. This is candidate Moore's first time having to answer questions about his background, and he should, and then the voters should assess.
Well, he has answered all of the questions, I think, that folks are asking. But you're saying that your campaign is not behind this dossier that the Moore campaign alleges in the filing with the Maryland State Board of Elections. If that's not the case, then do you know who is?
I do not.
And does it matter at the center of this? It has to do with discrepancies in whether or not Wes Moore lived in Baltimore as a child. He lives here now. He's lived here for 10 years. He went to college here. So he certainly has longstanding ties to the city of Baltimore. Should it matter one way or the other whether he lived in Baltimore or anywhere else or where you lived when you were a little kid in terms of being a governor? Is it something that voters should worry about?
I think it's more just disappointing that someone would promote a book with misrepresentations and in a way try to appropriate someone else's experience. And I think that's the core question that educators have who, have been asked to teach the book and use the book in classrooms. And I think, the candidate Moore needs to answer those questions about why he engaged in those misrepresentations.
So you even think that comparing himself to the other person named Wes Moore, whose life trajectory was different, was inappropriate?
Yeah, I think, look, walking down the streets of West Baltimore and saying these were our streets, which is what candidate Moore did, misrepresented the truth of his experience. And so, that's a question he needs to speak to, as well as some of the other questions that have been raised about promises he made about giving to charity and questions about the small business that he created and whether or not it was effective. But, those are all questions for him to answer. We're focused on talking about the vision that Michelle Seery and I have for what's possible in Maryland.
But, you lay all that out, and do you think personally that Mr. Moore is not credible, that he is not to be believed? I mean, obviously he's going to answer those questions. He has answered those questions. There's a whole website with that outlines the what he calls the facts of the case. The question is, are you saying that in your heart you believe Mr. Moore is not truthful and credible?
I don't think the questions have been answered satisfactorily, but that's going to be up to the voters to decide.
You've said that the that Maryland needs a teacher as a governor. You mentioned the great role that teachers have had in your life and the role that you've played in many students' lives as a teacher and principal yourself. Is there anything in particular about the profession of education that would lend itself to the job of being an executive over a huge state government like the state of Maryland? How do you see the direct correlation in experience translating to how it would inform your work as the governor?
Sure. A couple of things. One is, you know, teachers have to see the whole child, right? And governors need to see the whole person. We have to think about how transportation policy impacts economic opportunity. We have to think about how climate change impacts our health and well-being. We have to think about how whether or not someone has paid family leave may end up shaping whether or not they can support their family and stay in their home, right? So that you have to see that people don't exist in silos. They actually are whole people. And that's something that educators have to focus on. Another piece is that educators have to focus on building community. And one of our challenges as a state is to make sure that we see ourselves as one state, that we think about the fate of the kid in St. Mary's County as bound up with the fate of the kid in Potomac, that we see the fate of the small business in Hagerstown as bound up with the economic success of Baltimore County, that we're all interconnected. And that's something that, of course, educators have to convey and instill in their students and the families that they work with. You know, of course, for me, you know, having led at the local level, state level, federal level, having led a federal agency with a budget $15 billion bigger than the budget of the state of Maryland, you know, I certainly bring an executive experience, but the perspective of a teacher, I think, is a really valuable one to bring to state leadership.
There are 5 candidates of color in this field of 10 candidates, and you are among them. You have African and Puerto Rican descent. Why, in what ways is that important to you, and how should it be important to voters?
Well, look, you know, as a country, we have had only 2 African Americans ever elected governor in the United States. We've never had an Afro-Latino governor. So, you know, I take seriously the historic significance of potentially electing a governor of color. I certainly feel profoundly responsible to my ancestors who were enslaved here in Maryland. I live in Silver Spring in Montgomery County, about 25 miles from where my great-grandfather was enslaved in Gaithersburg, Maryland. The cabin that he and his family lived in as enslaved people is actually still standing on the property that is still owned by a family that are direct line descendants of the family that enslaved my family. I'm alive today because my ancestors survived. I've had the opportunities I have because my ancestors lived with faith in a future they could not see. And I take very seriously the responsibility to try to tackle some of the legacy of the institution of slavery that we see in our state, gaps in health and wealth, gaps in educational opportunity, gaps in our criminal justice system that are tied to our history around slavery, around segregation, redlining. And I think a governor's job is to try to advance opportunity for all and advance equity at the same time.
Having not held public office before, you know, folks in politics talk about starting with a core constituency. Sometimes they call that the base. whatever you refer to it as. You have a guy like Rashern Baker, a former executive in Prince George's County. You have Tom Perez, who has deep ties to the labor movement. You've got Peter Franchot, who has certainly long experience in government and ties to local and state government officials through those through that work. Wes Moore himself, just talking about him, he's, because of his public profile, is certainly well known. Do you think that you begin this campaign with a particular core constituency? I mean, given the fact, and you speak movingly and compellingly about your ancestors and the fact that it would be an historic achievement if an Afro-Latino man was elected governor of this state. But given the fact that when it comes to the racial makeup of the ballot, half of the people on the ballot can make some similar claim. Is there a particular core constituency that you began this campaign with and that gave you reason to believe that you could prevail?
Well, I certainly think education is an issue that cuts across every community in this state. I think everyone realizes education is at the foundation of the health of our economy and ultimately our democracy. I'm the only educator in the race. I'm also the only current public school parent in the race on either side, Democratic or Republican. So, you know, certainly as I travel around the state, talking about the centrality of education resonates with folks. We also have raised a tremendous amount of resources, and the most frequent profession from which we have raised money is an educator. So that centrality of education, I think, is an advantage for us. Certainly my experience serving in the Obama administration and getting big things done in government is an advantage over some of the candidates in the race who've never really been in government or led anything particularly large. And, you know, we are putting forward a message that resonates with folks around the role that government can and should play. There are a lot of candidates in this race who I would say are nibbling around the public policy edges and haven't been willing to be bold in their agenda around universal, affordable, quality childcare, around making Maryland one of the first states to be net zero greenhouse gas emissions. You know, the willingness to really see this as a New Deal moment where we take on some of our bigger systemic challenges as we recover from COVID.
John King, he is a candidate for governor in the Democratic primary. You can join our conversation on the other side of a quick break at 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org to tweet us at @MiddayWIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday, Angelo Corazon, the president of Media Matters, will join me to talk about what questions we should be asking about the pending purchase of Twitter by Elon Musk. And following this weekend's ceasefire events, a conversation with Leatrice Gant, Erica Bridgeford, and Michelle Schellers of the Baltimore Mediation Center about bringing conflict resolution skills to the street. If you've just joined us today, it's the latest installment in our series of conversations with the candidates. You can catch all of my interviews with candidates in primaries for several offices on the Midday webpage at WIPR.org. My guest today is Dr. John King, an educator and former U.S. Education Secretary, who's one of 10 candidates in the race to be the Democratic nominee for governor. To join our conversation with Dr. John King, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWIPR. By the way, you can tweet me at @TomHallWIPR. So, Dr. King, let's talk a little bit about some of your policy priorities. You have a whole group of proposals under which the rubric of which you call the Black agenda. It includes everything from economic development to education, housing, criminal justice reform, and the environment. Tell us what you mean by the Black agenda and how you've shaped this particular proposal.
Yeah, this really is a reflection of a deep commitment to equity and the reality that in our state, African Americans have face real gaps in economic opportunity, educational opportunity in our criminal justice system. We incarcerate young Black men at a rate in Maryland higher than Mississippi or Alabama, highest in the country. So there's a lot of work we need to do to address those equity gaps. And I think it's really important for candidates to be specific about that. So take, for example, the red line in Baltimore. Governor Hogan canceled the red line. It set the city's economic development back 20, 30 years to not have that light rail system that would help connect people to where the jobs are. Building the red line advances racial equity. We have in the state too often small business owners who are people of color, African-American or Latino, who are struggling to get access to capital. We've proposed launching a state bank that would make it easier for small businesses to get capital to start and grow their businesses and become employers in the state. That will help us to tackle the racial wealth gap. The blueprint for Maryland's future, the significant school funding reform measure that the General Assembly passed over Governor Hogan's veto, has an important racial equity component in that Baltimore and Prince George's County serve very large numbers of African-American students and have often gotten the short end of the stick in education funding. Governor Hogan even tried to cut $140 million from their budgets just this year. We've got to make sure that they have the resources to deliver a world-class education. We are all better.
Would you support the blueprint in its current iteration? I mean, do you think that the schedule that the blueprint lays out over the next several years is the right schedule? Is there any are there any changes you would propose to the blueprint?
It's a good start, and I worked with a coalition of civil rights organizations that advocated for the blueprint and advocated for some of the elements that were added to the blueprint during the legislative process. But I think there's more we need to do. I would accelerate the raises for teachers. I would add raises for education support professionals, the paraprofessionals, the administrative clerical staff in school districts who are doing vital work and who need to make a living wage. I would get us to universal child care, birth through five, including universal pre-K for three-year-olds and four-year-olds. So those are ways to build on the blueprint. Also, as we come out of COVID, I think we've got to address the impact COVID's had. We need more school counselors, more mental health services in our schools.
So you're talking about accelerating the timeline for the, because these are all things that are part of the blueprint already. You're just talking about doing it faster?
Accelerating the timeline and also building on top of the blueprint more ambitious elements. The blueprint, unfortunately, doesn't include raises for education support professionals. The blueprint commits to expanding pre-K for low-income students, but I really think we should get to universal pre-K the way that DC has. The blueprint commits some resources that would be helpful in terms of kids' socio-emotional well-being, but I think we need to do much more, especially coming out of COVID, to make sure that we have the school counselors and mental health services for kids and families that we need.
Let's go to the phones. We have a caller, Lauren, on the line from Pikesville. Welcome to Midday with Dr. John King.
Hi, this is Lauren. I'm an obstetrician from the Pikesville area. And my question is, what will you do to ensure abortion rights in our state and specifically to protect people in our state who may help others where abortion access is going to be illegal?
I'm so glad you asked this question, Lauren. You know, I was horrified, as many of us were, by the draft decision that was circulated earlier this week. I was out in front of the Supreme Court protesting. My running mate, Michelle Seery, was actually the board president for Planned Parenthood of Maryland. We are very committed to making sure that we protect abortion rights in Maryland. Abortion is healthcare, and also that we make Maryland the North Star for the region and really the country around abortion rights. That means I think we need a constitutional amendment to further secure the right to abortion in Maryland. We need to invest in the training of abortion providers, something that the General Assembly committed to, but the governor is withholding the funding now. Governor Hogan's withholding the funding.
But the General Assembly could have put the funding for that sooner, couldn't it have? I mean, the governor is simply saying, this is the law you sent me, and, you know, the law says that the funding doesn't become available for another year. That's his justification, as I understand it.
Yeah. He's putting his executive weight on the scale of slowing down the funding. And, you know, a number of members of the General Assembly just wrote to him, I think, today, urging him to instead move forward immediately with that training, because ultimately we need to make sure that we have the providers for Marylanders. In 2/3 of our counties, it's not possible to get an abortion today. So we need the training for Marylanders, but ultimately we also know that other states in the region are likely to restrict access to abortion significantly.
Yeah, and that could raise the number of people coming to Maryland to get
exactly
that procedure.
Right. That's exactly right. And we should be leading on that. And we should make Maryland a safe place. The other thing that Lauren raised is how do we protect providers? And Connecticut is just now moving forward with a law that would allow providers and women who have had abortions to countersue in response to these lawsuit-based restrictions on abortion that places like Texas are adopting. And that's the way that Connecticut is leaning in on the side of protecting patients and providers. And I think we should do something similar in Maryland.
Yeah, and we should, as you alluded to, remind folks that the legislature did expand abortion access just in this last section. They've put aside $3.5 million to do the training of people like nurses and midwives and physician's assistants to perform abortions, and the governor has refused to release that money, as I said, for reasons partially based in how the legislature wrote the law. We have an email from Jessica, who says, I have long respected Dr. King's career and appreciate his service in the Obama administration especially. My question relates to electability and prospective damage that such a large field could do to the Democratic nominee's chances in November. I noticed that Wes Moore has received the endorsement of the Maryland Teachers Association, which would have been an important constituency for Dr. King. I'm wondering, with all respect, whether Dr. King could make more of an impact on policy and governance in the next 4 years by supporting another candidate whose chances are better. I honor and respect that everyone has the right to run and has to be optimistic. I personally would love to see Maryland have its first black governor, but I'm afraid the number of candidates is going to make it harder for that to happen. There is some recent polling that you yourself, your campaign, commissioned. It's the largest sample of any of the internal polls that have come out so far. It's about 800 people, more than 800 people. Some of the others are 400 people, and it shows you at about 3%. What do you say to Jessica's contention that electability is going to be a bigger challenge for you than some of the other candidates?
You know, that poll was from an independent expenditure but group. And, you know, I think what that poll shows is really that undecided is leading by a very large margin. And that once voters have a sense of the candidates, who they are, what their background is, you know, we become one of the leading contenders. And so this is really about getting our message out. That poll was done before we went on television. We've raised the second most in the race, and we've been on television over the last 3-4 weeks. And so we see that as folks hear our message, we win. And so our task over the next 80 days or so is to make sure that we get our message out on the ground and on air.
Well, it's fewer than 70 days, actually, before early voting. And this Jessica's question is one that I've heard echoed by a lot of people. Perhaps one of the reasons that there are so many people undecided is because there is a very good crew of candidates in this race. There are a number of very highly qualified candidates, and people are having a difficult time making a decision. If you're polling now, and again, you're correct to correct me in that this was done by a group that supports your candidacy, but not your campaign directly. You're 17 points behind Peter Franchot, according to that poll. That's a lot of ground to make up. And Wes Moore is in second in this poll. He's at 13%, Rashearn Baker at 10%. There are people who are, nobody's blasting ahead at 40 or 50%.
Right.
But it's difficult for voters to decide. And, it is something that makes people wonder to say, can't these folks get together and have a conversation and decide, to narrow the choices a little bit?
Well, I think over the next few weeks, as folks really begin to focus on the race, and certainly, we've had COVID and we've got a war in Ukraine. There's been lots of things that are on people's minds that I think have led them not to focus on the governor's race. As people focus, as we begin to have debates, I think folks will have the opportunity to really contrast the candidates and our message on education, on economic dignity and economic development, on the environment, I think is the one that will ultimately resonate with voters. And again, undecided is leading by a very large margin in the race. And I think we will succeed in persuading folks to support our campaign. And Michelle Searin and I are enjoying the process of meeting voters all over the state and look forward to continuing to share our message.
John King, he's running in the Democratic primary for governor. We will have more with Dr. King on the other side of a quick break. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. To tweet us, @MiddayWYPR. To follow me in the Twitter sphere, @TomHallWYPR. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, it's another installment in our series of conversations with the candidates. My guest is John King. He is one of 10 candidates running in the Democratic primary for governor. Others in the race include Comptroller Peter Franchot, former Prince George's County Executive Rashearn Baker, former Labor Secretary Tom Perez, author and nonprofit executive Wes Moore, and former Maryland Attorney General Doug Gansler. To join our conversation with Dr. King, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us @MiddayWYPR. Let's go back to the phones to John in Parkville. He has the next question that I was going to ask you. We'll let John ask you instead. John, welcome to Midday with Dr. John King.
Good afternoon, Tom, and good afternoon, Dr. King. Given that the city political leadership can only advance change in Baltimore City by requesting help from the state, what, Dr. King, is your plan to reduce crime in Baltimore?
Yeah, thanks for that question. And look, public safety is foundational. You can't get to other things if you don't have public safety in place. Some of the things I think that we need to do, one is really focus police on stopping the flow of illegal guns and investigating violent crimes. The clearance rate for murders is very low in Baltimore. We've really got to focus the police department on those elements of their responsibility. Then we've got to supplement the work of the police department with other supports that we know advance public safety. We desperately need more addiction treatment. more mental health services. We need more investment in violence prevention programming, like Safe Streets, programs that engage trusted voices to try to stop the cycle of violence. We need more investment in reentry supports. You know, 95% of the folks who are incarcerated are coming home. And we've got to make sure that when folks do, they're able to do something productive and not end up right back in prison. When I was Secretary of Education, one of the things we worked on was restoring access to Pell Grants, the main federal assistance for higher education for folks who are incarcerated, so that folks could pursue education and job training while incarcerated and have a better shot at success when coming home. Those reentry supports would help us to address the cycle of crime and violence in the city. But ultimately, economic development is critical. If the Red Line had been built rather than canceled by Governor Hogan, there'd be less crime and violence. We need a neighborhood-based economic development strategy, education, transportation, affordable housing, those things that will make for a stronger, healthier community.
What about in terms of logistics and sort of the practical realities? For example, the Department of Probation and Parole, many folks have observed that that is very understaffed. Their caseloads are too high, and there are a lot of people who should be monitored more closely when they come out of prison who aren't. And a good bit of the crime being committed is being committed by those individuals. The Department of Probation and Parole, according to a survey a few months ago, at least, was some 14% down in the number of people that should be working in that department. The state government overall is down more than 8,000 positions. How do you attract somebody to come to work for the state of Maryland, for the Department of Probation and Parole? How do you train them? How do you get that department up and running in a way that is considerably more effective than it's currently been operating?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the great weaknesses of the Hogan era. Governor Hogan, you know, just doesn't believe in the role of government. And we see that in the thousands upon thousands of open positions across state agencies. Parole and probation is an example of underinvesting in the public service.
But how would you do it? How would you turn that around? It's a tough challenge.
It is a tough challenge. A couple things. One is we certainly need more staff. And one of the things that I will do as governor is review every agency at the outset and figure out what are the open positions that need to be filled? What are the positions that have been eliminated that need to be restored? What are the functions that have been contracted out ineffectively that need to be brought back into state government? But then I think we also need to broaden the mission around parole and probation. And this is connected to the idea of reentry supports. We are all better off if folks who are coming out of prison or on parole or probation have an opportunity to be successful. That means folks need help finding housing, getting an ID, finding work, mediation services to help them resolve conflicts with family members that may be in the way of them moving forward, addiction treatment. We have to really see it as in our interest to make a modest investment in reentry supports rather than bearing the cost of crime and violence, as well as reincarceration or recidivism.
I couldn't agree more, but just the logistics of finding people to do the work. How do you do that? You call the comptroller's office now, it's tax season, and you get a recording that says, sorry, we can't talk to you, call back later, we're too busy. There were parts of the website of the comptroller's office during tax season that weren't working. There were pages that were non-functional for weeks at a time. When Mr. Franchot, the current comptroller, was on the show the other day, he said, oh, well, we answer all the calls within 60 seconds, and we send out refunds within 2.2 days. He's got some average and some survey that he points to, but there are a number of people who beg to differ that the efficacy of state government, we had this come up with the unemployment insurance at the beginning of the COVID crisis. Mm-hmm. You know, how as the chief executive of the state, how do you fix that? How do you get folks to do a better job at the jobs they currently have? And how do you get more folks to do the work that needs to be done?
You know, one of the things that the states and cities that have been most effective in improving their customer service have done is to have a system of very clear metrics for every agency and real accountability when those metrics aren't met. You know, so when the Secretary of Labor failed to ensure that folks got their unemployment insurance, governor should have acted on that and replaced the Secretary of Labor. There should have been accountability for failure to deliver.
And I understand that impulse. That impulse, but doesn't that just create more chaos? Then all of a sudden you don't have a secretary, and you have somebody's acting secretary, and then somebody gets confirmed eventually. And it, I mean, doesn't that just extend the problem for another 6 months? I mean, firing people is one solution, but it's often a solution that's even more disruptive than just fixing what's wrong.
Well, in order to fix what's wrong, you have to have both transparency around the data on whether or not the service is being delivered effectively, and a sense that there's accountability for making it better. So you want to recruit the best possible team, and then you've got to make sure that those people on the team know they're responsible for the outcomes. You know, one of the things I worked on when I was Secretary of Education was tackling the issue of predatory for-profit colleges that were taking advantage of students. And we launched an enforcement unit. We recruited the best possible people with experience in consumer protection to lead that enforcement unit. We assessed all of our regulatory tools that we could use to go after those institutions that were taking advantage of students. We shut many of them down, and we canceled the debt for students. It began the process of canceling the debt for students who were taken advantage of by those institutions. And as the secretary, I made it clear to everyone, our priority was protecting our students. And we had regular meetings to look at the data on how we were doing in tackling this problem of predatory for-profit colleges. We need that kind of engaged executive leadership, and we haven't had that.
The three things that folks here in the city of Baltimore often point to as the things that are of most concern to them. One of them is the caller's concern about public safety. The other is transportation. And you mentioned that the Red Line, of course, was canceled by Governor Hogan. And there's a lot of people in Baltimore who were appalled by that decision. There's plenty of people in neighborhoods like Canton who were quite happy with it. The third is the fate of State Center. The State Center complex over a long, long period, 12, 14 years back to the Ehrlich administration, a plan was developed. It was nixed by the governor and the Board of Estimates. What do you think should happen with State Center? You mentioned you would want to revive the Red Line. I don't know where the magic money comes for that. And I also don't know where the magic money comes for State Center. What's your take on where we should go with that development?
Yeah. Well, let me say, on both the Red Line and State Center, I think there's an opportunity to both access federal infrastructure dollars to try to engage on those projects, and also an opportunity to use some of our significant state surplus to invest in the long-term infrastructure we need for economic success. In particular, with State Center, I think one of the things we've got to figure out is what are the highest leverage investments that would drive ongoing economic development. For example, Maryland should be a national leader in life sciences. We've got Johns Hopkins, we've got NIH, we've got FDA. One of the obstacles in becoming that national leader in life sciences is we don't have enough lab space. And so is there an opportunity to think about lab space? We need to do a lot of work to tackle climate change and to improve our supply of renewable energy. Is there an opportunity to think about the role for the renewable energy industry in that space? we have a desperate need for more folks in cybersecurity throughout the broader DC region, public sector and private sector. Are there opportunities to locate the cybersecurity industry there? One of the things we've called for is the creation of a state bank, which would allow the state to put its assets into the state bank and then partner with community banks to make it easier for folks to get capital to start and grow businesses. We can create incentives for folks to build their businesses in the state center space. So it's a broader vision for economic development for Baltimore, but I think the next governor has to see the success of the city as central to the success of the state.
Got a minute or so left. Tell us a little bit about your running mate. You mentioned her earlier in our conversation, Michelle Seery. She is the executive director of the Women's Law Center of Maryland. Like yourself, no elective office held to this at this point in her career. What does she bring to the team?
Michelle is from Baltimore County. She was an assistant attorney general. She was the board president at Planned Parenthood and leads, as you said, the Women's Law Center of Maryland, which has been one of the leading advocates for gender equity in the state, working on issues like equal pay for equal work, paid family leave, the protection of abortion rights. She is going to be a phenomenal partner and has worked closely with legislators and advocates in Annapolis for years to try to make life better for Marylanders. And that's why she's such a wonderful partner.
I don't have much time to give you to answer this question, but we have a listener, Philip, who says, how does the public deal with the split vote among African-American candidates? Won't this just ensure that Mr. Franchot will win? Perhaps we need to move to a system that allows for additions and primaries until somebody receives 50%. How do you answer those concerns?
Yeah, look, at the end of the day, I think folks have to assess the candidates and ask who has both the experience in government and the vision for the role that government can play in people's lives, advancing world-class education for all kids, economic dignity, real action on climate. You know, who's that candidate, and support that candidate and not get trapped into the lesser of the evils, but really try to figure out who's the person who best reflects the vision for a more just and prosperous future for the state.
Dr. John King is a candidate in the Democratic primary for governor. Primary election day is July 19th, and early voting begins on July 7th. Dr. King, thank you so much. I've enjoyed our conversation. I appreciate the time.
Thanks so much for the conversation.
Over the next few weeks, we will continue our series of conversations with the candidates. I'll be speaking with John Barron, a Democrat running for governor, Tim Adams, the mayor of Bowie, who's running for comptroller, and Marilyn Mosby, who is standing for re-election as Baltimore City State's attorney. That's it for us today. Coming up Monday, a conversation about the future of Twitter with the president of Media Matters of America, Angelo Carusone, plus Erica Bridgeford, Leatrice Gant, and Michelle Schellers of the Baltimore Community Mediation Center will reflect on this weekend's Baltimore ceasefire events. Midday's director and engineer is Ellen Spicknell's son. Yvonne Harrington Pinkard's daughter and Doris Sivak's son are our producers. Doris turned 99 this week, so happy birthday, Doris. Way to go. And Gail Williams' daughter is WIPR's digital content director. Margaret Northam's son wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. I'm Rosemary Hall's rotten kid and proud of it. Thanks for listening. Happy Mother's Day to all moms everywhere. All of us kids at Midday wish you all a great Mother's Day weekend. Take care.
This is 88.1 WYPR.